Distinguished guests, members of the New South Wales Diplomatic Corps, friends and supporters of the Lowy Institute, President of the Human Rights Commission, and supporters generally, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute and to this very important speech by the Australian Ambassador for Women and Girls, Ms. Natasha Stott Despoja AM. I am Alex Oliver. I'm the Director of the Institute's Public Opinion Program. Apart from my role managing the annual Lowy Institute poll, I'm also responsible for the Institute's work on Australia's diplomacy and, in particular, on the fitness of our diplomacy and diplomatic network for the challenges of the 21st century. One of the important additions to Australia's diplomacy has been the creation in 2011 of the Australian Ambassador for Women and Girls. Ambassador Stott Despoja was appointed to this role in 2013 as only the second such ambassador. And as such, she is a roving envoy, and I believe she's taken more than 40 trips in the last few years. She's tasked with ensuring that the empowerment of women and girls is a central focus of Australia's diplomatic development and defence concerns, and to give women a stronger voice in the world with a particular focus on our region. This is not a small task. Just a few examples of the scale of the challenge. In low-income countries, many of which are in our region, women are 20 times more likely to die during childbirth, and a third of them are married before they turn 18. In those low-income countries, there's a theme here, only 63% of young women aged between 15 and 24 are literate. In high-income countries, this statistic is near 100%. Less than 29% of women continue to secondary schools in those low-income countries. Girls represent 2 out of every 3 child trafficking victims. And in statistics which we've become frighteningly familiar with over the last few years, as many as 2 in 3 women in some parts of our region have experienced physical or sexual violence. Even in Australia, it's 1 in 4 women, according to statistics published by Our Watch, an organisation to prevent gendered violence, which Ms. Stott Despoja chairs. In our own country, a woman is murdered every week by a current or former partner. Less sinister, but equally damaging to women and global economic progress generally, in some parts of the world, only 1 in 5 women participate in the labour force. Women still earn 24% less than men, and even in an advanced economy such as Australia, men out-earn women by 23%. Ambassador Stott Despoja was the youngest woman ever to enter the Australian Federal Parliament in her mid-20s. As Senator for South Australia from 1995 to 2008, she became the leader of the Australian Democrats in 2001. I'm sure you're very familiar with this history. She is the longest serving Democrat senator in the party's history. Apart from her role as ambassador, she's a member of the World Bank Gender Advisory Board and also of the recently established UN High-Level Working Group on Health and Human Rights of Women, Children and Adolescents, with the goal of generating high-level political support at both national and international levels for the implementation of the human rights-related measures called for under the UN Global Strategy. She is the inaugural chair of Our Watch, founded by the Commonwealth and Victorian governments to prevent violence against women and their children, and this is a role I believe she's going to continue in the future. Importantly, Natasha, like me, is from Adelaide, which makes her a really, really great person on top of all of her other achievements. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Natasha Stott Despoja.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Alex, for that introduction. I begin, of course, by acknowledging the traditional owners. I pay my respects to their elders past and present, and of course to any elders from other communities who may be present or listening today. I also acknowledge Dr. Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of this wonderful institute, and his team, the Diplomatic Corps, and any other distinguished guests that are here today. I certainly see there are many representatives of partners from civil society, from business and from NGOs with whom I've had the pleasure to work. Anne Summers, Ava Cox, I simply genuflect, and I thank everyone for being here today. I laugh when I get introduced as the youngest woman to have ever entered Parliament, Federal Parliament, because that's often said about me in the Pacific region now when I go and speak with women in schools and or in parliaments, and they look at me with a sense of, crikey, what's the average age of the Australian Parliament if she's the youngest ever? I speak to you today, and thank you for the opportunity to do so. It's a little wistful, given that my time as Ambassador for Women and Girls is about to conclude, but I do so very proud of the work that we've done in advancing gender equality internationally and in the region specifically, and particularly empowering young women, women and girls. However, no one country in the world has got gender equality right. And despite enormous progress, the issues facing women and girls have to be, if not the, one of the greatest human rights challenges for this century. Forgive me, I didn't acknowledge you, Madam President, President of the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, Gillian Triggs. You've heard some of the statistics. Women around the world are not free from the injustices of inequality. We don't experience the full realisation of fundamental rights. Women are more likely to experience violence and abuse. They're more likely to be economically dependent and work in vulnerable, low-paid and undervalued jobs. Women and children are far more likely to bear the cost of water, food and fuel insecurity, and more likely to die as a result of natural disasters. In the past 3 years, I have seen tremendous work, tremendous steps forward on the issue of gender equality, but we know we are not there yet. There's a lot of work to do. You've heard I've done 45 country trips in the last almost 3 years, 31 different countries. I've worked with partners from civil society, from government, from the private sector to achieve the aspirations of women and girls, whether that's the provision of sexual and reproductive health services and resources to girls in Fiji, whether it's training ophthalmic paediatrics in India, whether it's working with the World Food Programme in schools in Kenya. So it's impossible today to sum up the experiences I've had over the past 3 years. So I'm going to try and give a bit of a snapshot of some of the work that we do and some thoughts maybe on advancing gender equality into the future. Only 2 weeks ago, I returned from my last trip as Ambassador for Women and Girls internationally. It was to Vanuatu, and I was there for the 25th of November, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, and the launch of 16 Days of Activism. In Port Vila, my last announcement was $1 million from the Gender Equality Fund to work with CARE International on increasing women's voice and agency and eliminating violence against women and girls. I played cricket in the searing heat with cricket mamas aged 20 to 70. I did my best not to emulate smooth moves of a former prime minister some things you can't unsee, but anyway. I talked with MPs, indeed the prime minister, and women about representation or lack of in the parliament in Vanuatu because there are no women in the national legislature there. I visited the Vanuatu Women's Centre, which we've funded since 1994. Not many people know that. Run by the renowned Marilyn Tahi. We talked about violence against women. Why? In Vanuatu, 72% of Ni-Vanuatu women have experienced some form of physical or sexual abuse. Essentially, what I'm saying is that this visit epitomised the work that I've done over the last 3 years, or the work of the role, encompassing the three core areas: economic empowerment, eliminating violence against women and girls, and supporting women's participation and leadership. Those three pillars reflect the gender equality strategy that was launched by the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, in February this year. And it does place, as Alex said, it does place gender at the core of our foreign policy work and indeed our international development work. The focus, geographic focus of my work has been the Indo-Pacific region, a region where Australia has both the greatest capacity to influence change and the region where intervention is most urgently required. So in the Pacific, for example, rates of violence against women, domestic, family and sexual violence, are as high as 60 to 70%, up to 90% in some parts of Papua New Guinea. We know that representation of parliamentarians or representation of women in parliament, fewer than 6% of parliamentarians are female. In the past 3 years, I've seen great goodwill towards Australia in terms of the work that we do in this space internationally. Phumzile Malambo Nuka, some of you will know, is the director of UN Women. She paid us the greatest compliment recently when she compared me to a pig. She said the difference between involvement and commitment is like ham and eggs. The chicken's involved, the pig is committed. Admittedly, this was after, on at least one occasion, where Felicity Volk, the former director of the Ambassador for Women and Girls Office, and we sat for 7 hours straight, spot the girly swats in the International Forum, 7 hours as we watched the UN Leaders Summit, where male and female leaders got to stand up at the UN during UNGA and declare their commitment on gender equality. Phumzile, who's just been in PNG, I think according to her Twitter feed, she's in Bougainville right now. She's due to come to Australia next year, but she was very positive about the work that we were doing. And I believe that it does sum up our work on gender. We are committed, and I hope we're in it for the long haul. The relatively early appointment of an Ambassador for Women Girls position, initially held by career diplomat Penny Williams, whose shoes I was very honoured to fill, I thought it was a sign by the former government, was the Gillard government that made the appointment, of the significance of gender equality work in the international arena. This commitment has been enhanced by the current government with a gender target. So 80% of all our work, all our international development and aid work, has to effectively address gender equality in its implementation. We're actually the second country in the world to create the position. Hillary Clinton appointed the first ambassador, Milan Vivier, and since then we've gathered a few more. We're like a handful. I don't know what the collective noun is, but we're a posse. Yeah. We've added Sweden and Finland to our ranks, and the Seychelles. Interesting. Got a bit of title envy with Sweden. She gets to be an ambassador for global women's issues and a feminist foreign policy, but I'm working on it, trust me, folks. We have pretty much the same mandates, and I reiterate again because it's the best way for me to address perhaps the priority areas today. The first, increasing women's economic empowerment. The second, eliminating violence against women and girls, including in conflict and humanitarian settings and through the Women, Peace and Security agenda. And the third is increasing women's participation in leadership and decision making. A report by the McKinsey Global Institute noted that gender equality is not only a pressing social and moral issue, but also a critical economic challenge. According to McKinsey economists, if each country matched the progress towards gender parity of its fastest moving regional neighbour, global GDP would increase by $12 trillion, or by 11%, in 2025. Again, you've heard some of the statistics, but 70% of the world's poor are women. 64% of adult illiterate people in the world are women. We know that women reinvest 90% of their incomes back into the household, whereas men, around 30 to 40%. And when women have more influence over economic decisions, their families allocate more money to food, to health, to children's clothing, to education, to children's nutrition. So in a full potential scenario, where women played an identical role to that of men in the workforce, as much as $28 trillion US, or 26%, could be added to global GDP by 2025. I use that because I sometimes think if you're not pressed by the social and moral argument, surely leaders will be swayed by the economic argument. Of course, realising this potential begins with the full and equal access to education for girls, and that means addressing the many resources, cultural and other hurdles to girls' education. I mean, it's little wonder that in 2014, the UN Human Development Report described educating women as the silver bullet in human development, the closest thing. More than 65 million girls around the world are out of school, and yet an extra year of education beyond the average boosts girls' eventual wages by 10 to 20%. Even an increase of 1% in girls' secondary education attendance adds 0.3% to a country's GDP. And we're working in schools. There are a range of places that I've been to, whether it's in Kenya, the Kibera School in the Stara Rescue Centre. It's one of the largest slums in Africa. You know, we get to sit down and talk to young girls about what stops them going to school. Menstruation, big one, so providing resources, providing toilets, we do that. But at the same time, we work with the World Food Programme to ensure that these children, boys and girls, many of whom were in the sex industry, so they can actually eat so they can go to school. I've been to places in Argentina, like the Campo de Mayo province just out of Buenos Aires, where we refurbish libraries and we work with girls who are getting some training and skills education. I say that to sort of illustrate the breadth because it is so hard to explain, but I'm happy to take questions on some of the specific programs. We work with many partners, including Care International, to ensure that women have access to decent work. And I've seen this work for firsthand, and I've announced many commitments ranging from, you know, microfinance or funding schemes in Indonesia, market stalls across the Pacific. We developed the bilum trade. I mean, you know, those wonderful bilums that are made, particularly in PNG, taking that from women working in the informal economy, using their craft and their skills to actually providing training, but also export opportunities and all the things that come with it. We support cocoa farmers, we support coffee growers, we support coconut oil production, all primarily involving women, but making sure that women can increase their economic empowerment. Financial literacy, access to bank accounts, supporting business coalitions like the Business Coalition in PNG, the Women's Business Coalition. Last time I was in PNG with that group, we launched a toolkit so that businesses could actually understand the impact of domestic and family violence on their bottom line and they could work it out for themselves. I've sat with women in places like Phnom Penh when we are in garment industries and during their lunch hours, Australia's funded programs with CARE, with Save the Children, with the Cambodian government, with Marie Stopes International, so that they can learn about their sexual and reproductive health rights. Sexual and reproductive health, absolutely critical. So apart from the economic argument, obviously I'm always conscious of the link between gender inequality and violence against women. So economic empowerment is one part of addressing those issues. Violence, well, of course, one of the most heinous manifestations of gender inequality across the world is violence against women and girls. I know some of you know the statistics, but globally, more than one in three women have been beaten, coerced, intersex, or abused in some way. Every 10 minutes in the world, an adolescent girl will die as a result of violence. Up to 80% of men in the Pacific actually admit to perpetrating physical and or sexual violence against women and girls in their lifetime. Child marriage affects around 14 million girls every year, robbing them both of their childhood and their future potential. And pregnancy, as you've heard from Alex in the introduction, it's the leading cause of death for women aged 15 to 19. I mean, a girl in South Sudan today is more likely to die in childbirth than she is to finish primary school. The use of rape as a tactic of war in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere, the trafficking of women into sexual slavery and domestic servitude, sexual violence against internally displaced women and girls, the kidnapping of girls in parts of Africa, or of course, attacks on girls for having the, even getting on a bus so that they can go to school. And the daily horror of domestic and family violence across the world, but particularly in the Pacific and including, as you've said, in Australia. These are just a few examples of the myriad appalling patterns of gender-based violence around the globe. We know that in some parts of the Pacific, rates of violence are as high as 2 in 3 surveyed women. But ladies and gentlemen, I say this to illustrate the fact that everywhere I go, I've seen the effects of violence. I see the shame and the stigma. I see the aftermath, physical, emotional. I've met with women who have come into clinics to visit me who've just had their limb severed. I mean, it is haunting, the violence. And I know some of you work in this space and I pay tribute to those of you who work day in and day out to keep women and children safe. But we do work in this space. A lot of people don't know this. Australia provides support for survivors, for victims, and we do it in a range of ways. We support legislative and policy work to change laws and rules that save lives, change lives for the better. We assist in the implementation of laws, just as we help with enforcement. I've been in a lot of police stations in the last few years, whether it's in cells in Samoa or opening family and sexual violence units in places like Baroko in Papua New Guinea. And the women, I mean, the fact that we've funded the Vanuatu Women's Shelter for many, many years, but we do it in Tonga as well, and we do it all across the Pacific. You know, amazing women. Shamima Ali, some of you may know of, who runs the centre in Fiji, Offa Gutenbill Liki Liki, who works in Tonga. I just show off saying her name and I still stuffed it up. But these amazing women who do extraordinary work, we support them and I'm proud of that, and I don't think that enough people realise that. We invest in prevention. So some of the work that we're doing, I see Heather Nancaro from ANROS here, the work that we're doing in Australia, primary prevention, is not lost in the Pacific. So whether it's sitting under trees talking to men about respectful relationships in, you know, the Eastern Highlands province, whether it's going to the Sisters of Nazareth shelter in Bougainville, a lot of the primary prevention work is taking hold, and sport, you know, apart from my pathetic bowling and cricket, the power of sport, which many of you know. So League Belong Life, Equal Playing Field, a lot of these programs we run in schools to address issues of gender equality. We work with Hagar in Cambodia. What an extraordinary organisation, one that helps to enable women and children to live empowered, productive lives despite extraordinary trauma, extraordinary trauma. We support Oxfam Human Rights Defenders, some of the bravest people I've ever met in the world. And we work in conflict and post-conflict environments, so like Solomon's, like Sri Lanka, like Bougainville, for example. We've been key actors in the women, peace and security space. I've been proud of the work that we've done in supporting or developing United Nations Security Council resolutions, specifically 1325 and subsequent resolutions. Indeed, in 2015, the Council unanimously adopted Resolution 2242, which recognises the central role of women's participation in global efforts to achieve peace and security. And I believe strongly we've got to step up globally our efforts to include women and girls as key actors in countering violent extremism, and I'm happy to expand on that. But I think recognising that not only the intersection between gender and CVE, obviously including women suffer terrible and degrading traumatic acts as a consequence of that, but also recognising that it's, you know, some perverted notions of masculinity that often get, you know, drive young men to join extremist groups. I think it's a challenge to also recognise the role of women in that space who might actually make conscious decisions to get involved. I'm trying to say that women are not only victims, but they're actors, and they can be used as better agents of change in this space. But I do think we've got some rather simplistic notions of the engagement of women in CVE, but I might move on from that. I think another area where we've been really good, and there's been efforts led by the United Kingdom in particular, has been preventing sexual violence in conflict. Having said that, I think that's something that could be stepped up too. I think Australia could play a bigger role in that space. Some of you may remember the Eliminating Sexual Violence in Conflict Summit in 2014. After the sort of stewardship of Secretary Haig, after the Foreign Secretary of the UK left, that sort of waned, hasn't it? It's a lot to be said for a bit of star power, people. Whatever you think of Angelina Jolie, she got this front page. She also got me to meet Brad Pitt, but that is another story, people. I tell it against myself. I met him once, and then about 10 minutes later, someone was about to reintroduce me, and he went, "So, we meet again." That's good, isn't it? My ovaries burst at that point, but that's... I digress. My last conversation when I left Vanuatu was with this extraordinary young woman. She was an actor. She'd survived, you know, teen pregnancy, abuse by her family, thrown out of her family. And we were talking about sexual reproductive health, great activist advocate. And she said to me, because I asked her about violence, and she said, "Ambassador, of course if I stay out too late with my girlfriends, I should expect a slap when I get home. It's only discipline." Made me realise how much work we have to do in this space. She's one of the 60% of Ni Vanuatu women who believe that violence against them is justified. Which brings me to leadership and women's voices. Across the world, you've heard, we're underrepresented in decision-making institutions, especially in parliaments. The global average is around 22%, but 4 out of the 5 countries in the world that have no representation of women are in the Pacific. We know that women's leadership, economic empowerment and eliminating violence are all interlinked, but we are not, and I'm convinced of this after 3 years more than ever, we are not going to make progress on those related issues until women are reflected in decision-making institutions. Yes, I would say that, wouldn't I? But my views on this are not only formed as a former Member of Parliament, and one who knows full well that women don't always have a ameliorating effect on the chamber, but we deserve to be reflected and represented in all our diversity, and we do make a difference. The conclusion of one study says, increasing women's representation in elected office not only ensures decisions are more representative of the voting population, but can lead to increased provision of public goods, better natural resource management, and increase in the reporting of crimes against women. Research even shows that a decrease of women in Parliament by 5% means a country is five times more likely to utilise military means as a form of resolving conflict or resolving an argument. And there is a proven connection between women in leadership positions and greater effect or greater attempts to redress the issue of violence. And I see that. I see Governor Soso, Julie Soso, in the Eastern Highland province in Papua New Guinea, or even the heightened attempts by the United Nations to address issues of violence against women. It coincides with more women being in those senior ranks and making it clear that this is a pivotal issue. One of my favourite pieces of research is one that shows that more women in leadership positions changes the perceptions regarding the roles and aspirations of young girls, including they reduce the amount of time spent on household chores, girls are more likely to attend school and themselves feel more equipped to take on leadership positions, including when it comes to conflict prevention. And conflict prevention, probably not a lot of time now, but we know the facts are in. You know, peace agreements that involve women, mediators, negotiators, signatories and witnesses, they're more likely to succeed. 20% chance of succeeding for 2 years if you have women at the table. 35% chance of enduring if you have women in those processes. But back to women in Parliament. Each year I've hosted the Pacific Women's Parliamentary Partnership Program, because there's not enough P's in that sentence, but for the Foreign Minister. And it's got women from all around the Pacific together, including Australia and New Zealand. It's been one of the best things we've done, and I don't want to see it stopped. It's just a message for people in the room. Not that it will be, I'm sure. But women networking together is as good as having a conference on a specific topic. These women getting together and sharing stories, you know, particularly on the issue of quotas. I mean, some of the stories have been quite contrasting. I love it when former Speaker Anna Burke talks about, you know, the first time she was mentored or twinning with one of these women. And, you know, Anna was like, oh, yeah, it's so difficult, door knocking, and there's so much to do. And the woman said, yeah, I found it difficult too, because I have to canoe across crocodile-infested waters in order to get to my constituency. We're like, you win. It's all good. But the issue of quotas, it may be a thorny one for people in Australia, but it's a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. We know they work. And if there's one impression I can leave on governments and other people, this has to be a core component of the work that we do in our advocacy and our development. We know in Samoa this year they reached 10% for the first time as a consequence of the introduction of quotas. We know it's worked in Vanuatu at a municipal level. We know elsewhere, Bougainville, where four women were elected in the last set of elections, one without the quota, but just changing the idea that women get in there. But you know what? I just want women in there. If I hear the word merit again, I tell you, I'll run away from this feminist ambassador because I'll just lose it. They're there. They're capable. They're able. Women are running most of these countries already. I mean, Vanuatu, if they weren't the Solicitor General, they were the acting Solicitor General, Attorney General. You know, all, these women are there. They're talented and they're ready. So we have to think about when we put money into those leadership programs, a lot of the time we're looking to train women. They're already trained. We need to make it very clear to men who run these countries, women need to be in their parliaments. We've got a great program, Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development. I'm really proud of it. It's a flagship. It was started by the Gillard government. It's continued under this government. $320 million over 10 years, 14 countries, tailored and targeted. We work in partnership with government, civil society and women on the ground to deliver these programs, to look after those three pillars to which I referred. Achievements in its first 4 years include more than 22,000 women have been provided support services, including legal, counselling, health services. More than 3,000 women have had access to financial information and services, including financial literacy training. And more than 9,000 women have been supported to take on leadership roles in community, national, and municipal levels. And it's not the only area in which we work. I mean, I could give you a whole list of the places that I've been to alone this year representing various ministers, whether it's the World Humanitarian Summit or the Women Deliver Conference, CHOGM, APEC, etc. This is in addition, of course, to the regular UN meetings, such as Commission on the Status of Women. During these and other events, I've launched around 30 policies or made funding announcements for Australian-supported projects. And it's been really important to me to see our region reflected in these international fora, because sometimes I feel the Pacific is invisible. And we have a role as a country, as a government, as well as private sector, to ensure that that's not the case, that our views are heard, that it is that the women particularly of this region are reflected and represented, or men and women, you know, our brothers and sisters in the Pacific who are working for gender equality. And I know that Lowy does good work in this respect. I was talking to someone the other day who said, where's the Q&A on Australia's role in the Pacific region? Because we do it vis-a-vis other countries, other ideas. And I know one Member of Parliament suggested you change the domestic travel arrangements for MPs so that Papua New Guinea is on the list. So before you go anywhere, you start thinking in terms of, oh, what's happening in our region before I, you know, head overseas elsewhere, shall we say. And other countries are constantly impressed by the work that we do. I've just recently travelled to Papua New Guinea with my US counterpart, Kathy Russell. Bad week to travel with her was the week of the election result. But she was impressed by the work that we were doing. Mind you, the two of us are wondering, what did the election of President-elect Trump mean for women's issues, not only specifically in terms of the outreach and the work that the US is doing, but what is the message it sends the rest of the world? I suspect there's a heightened role now for Australia in our international work in this space. For my successor, Dr. Sharman Stone, particularly with her qualifications and passion for sexual and reproductive health work. But I wonder, you know, what demonstrable impact it may have on foreign policy. And I'm proud of my compatriots. Everywhere I go, there are men and women doing great work, whether it's Julia Gillard through the Global Partnership, whether it's a woman called Louise Allen, who's the executive coordinator of the NGO Working Group on Women, Peace and Security, whether it's Kate Gilmore, who is the Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. Your countrymen and women do you proud. And I know many of you know that because you work in this space, but I often want to reiterate it because I also think if more MPs, more leaders were aware of the fact that we do good work with our international development budgets and in our foreign policy space, I don't know, maybe it would make a difference. Am I being naive? No. We're going to talk more about international development in terms of not only safety and security of the region, but why it's important from a human rights perspective and particularly in relation to women. And I know there are sceptics. I get them every day on social media. Thank you. I still love, though, my favourite is the former political leader who dedicated a column to why appointments like the Ambassador for Women and Girls position was so that the Natasha Stott Despoys of the world could join the diplomatic cocktail circuit. I think of that comment often when I'm in slums in India or domestic violence shelters. Having said that, my last night in Vanuatu, there was a reception at the residence, and I thank the High Commissioner for letting me live the dream. But the takeaway tip on that event is do not have kava before giving the speech. Just, you know. Australia's approach mirrors the global approach that we're seeing everywhere. The Sustainable Development Goals. I mean, what a gift that is. Kate Gilmore describes it as a gift. It's one way, you know, it's given us a 15-year blueprint for advancing human rights. There are many other developments over the last couple of years that give us a bit of a pathway. But in today's development context, our work to end gender equality is actually going, inequality is going to be carried out amidst an array of challenges, ones that have unique and specific impacts on women. Economic and social shifts, yes, they do create new opportunities, but also new risks. Fast technological progress and deepening globalisation does offer opportunities for some, but acute challenges for others, particularly women who are underrepresented in the formal labour market, concentrated in those lower wage jobs and have less access to resources to support their economic participation. Women and girls disproportionately affected, of course, by the fact that we have the most profound displacement crisis since the Second World War. Many, many countries affected by natural disasters, climate change, the list goes on. And these challenges mirror the challenges to women's representation in political spheres as well as at sub-national level when it comes to decision-making in economic life, in financial institutions, digital inclusion in social and family affairs. All of these areas present particular challenges for women. I know the UN has a blueprint, Planet 50-50 by 2030, but I don't know about you. I'm actually quite impatient about it. That's why I keep saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Robert Louis Stevenson said, to travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive. Well, yes, may we travel hopefully, yes, but may we arrive soon. Gender equality, surely there is no better example of a destination being more desirable than the journey. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. That was a really, really interesting speech. It's first for me. It's the first time I've heard pigs, Brad Pitt and ovaries all in one speech at the Lowy Institute. We're now going to ask, we're going to go to a question and answer session for about the next 20 or so minutes. Mm-hmm. If I can ask you please to confine yourself to a question, and when the microphone comes to you, and there should be one or two roving microphones towards the end, so just put your hand up, but identify yourself if you wouldn't mind. I'll provide an affiliation. I'm going to ask the first question myself because that's one of my perks. We talked briefly about the role of development assistance and a debate which has developed recently and which comes up from time to time about how important development assistance actually is for Australia. You've raised the issue of how important this role is to women's development globally and to their economic empowerment. What are the sort of arguments you would use to say, why is it good for Australia to have created a role such as yours and to be putting its investment and resources into a role like this?
Thank you. Hopefully I've at least tried to encapsulate some of those arguments in my comments. But one thing I know is that symbolism matters too. And Australia made a quite definitive symbolic gesture when they created this position. They said that international development matters generally, but the rights and the empowerment of women and girls, note we're the only ones that have an ambassador that has girls in the title, but this specifically is something that's important to us. Obviously, substance matters too, and I'm glad that we back it up. We back it up with a target, we back it up with funding, and there'll be always debates about foreign aid funding. And don't get me wrong, I'm a lifelong advocate, you know, my working life, particularly as a former politician, for advocating for increased aid in the space. But I'm glad that now the strategy that the government has implemented makes it core. It is central. So we recognise not only that this is good for women and girls and that, you know, it's good for the region, there are economic and social and all these other arguments that go around that, but it's actually the answer to resolving the broader issues in relation to the international development space. Poverty. Well, we can't address poverty without lifting women out of poverty. We can't address violence unless we address the issue of economic empowerment of women, ending gender inequality, ensuring that women have livelihoods and opportunities and choices, and of course education, it underpins everything. So it's actually the answer to a lot of the problems that our leaders identify. Whether it's the economic issues, I mean, so many leaders, whether it's, you know, Abe in Japan or whether it's Modi in India or even our own Prime Minister, when they talk about the need for economic growth. Well, hey, we can give you a quick fix right there. And don't get me wrong, I don't like only talking about women's development in the context of why it's economically good for your country, because in some Pacific countries or elsewhere, I get concerned about the double burden on women now. So we need you to go out and do the work, but at the same time, we're not actually talking about dealing with some of the family, caring and other responsibilities that we know all over the world still fall primarily to women and obviously compounded by a range of other factors in other places and countries and contexts. So, yeah, it's a no-brainer in terms of the economic effects, but more broadly, I'm proud of the fact that we're symbolic. And I talked about those aspirational, the research that shows changes to aspirations. And I know I've said this before. You've heard me say, you know, my daughter Cordelia really shocked when Kevin Rudd became Prime Minister for the second time when Julia Gillard lost the position because she genuinely didn't believe that boys could be Prime Minister. It matters in every context what we see and how we see and view women. It all matters and it all adds up.
Okay, so I don't want to hog the floor. Questions, hands up everywhere. I think in the front and the third row there.
Thank you, Natasha. That was the point you just brought up, Eva Cox, by the way, I'm just else. The point you just brought up was one that was concerning me, and I'd just like to get you to do that. How do we put the social back on the agenda? We bang on interminably about GDP, which can be increased by car accidents, bushfires, and all of those other antisocial type activities. We make that a real thing, you know, now we're going to have childcare only for people who increase GDP. How do we actually put back, and the point you were last making, the unpaid work of women and the unpaid work of everybody, because if we're going to move into an area where robots are going to be doing lots more of the work, we need to get back to the idea of shortening working hours and possibly increasing the importance of the unpaid, the community, the relationships, all of those things that don't count as GDP. And being old enough to remember when we started banging on interminably about economics, which was in the 1980s, I think that time is beginning to go. So my question is, how do we actually provide women's leadership on what's important that isn't economic or at least isn't counted in GDP? Because that's where women lose out. And as you say, we cannot ignore that because that's what makes life worth living in most cases.
Do you want to take another one as well?
Sure. Okay. In the third row, there was... Yes.
Oh, thank you, Natasha. Angela Priestley from Women's Agenda. My question is actually quite different. I wanted to ask about just if you could expand on your idea that you said about quotas in the Pacific, about potentially tying those to our development work there, what you mean by that, how that might work, and if it's something that we could do when Australia isn't exactly leading on that ourselves in terms of representation of women in Parliament.
Okay. Is there one more? I think there was a gentleman. Oh, sorry, he's gone. And lady here. Thank you.
Thanks. Laura Shepherd from UNSW Australia. You mentioned the Women, Peace, Security agenda briefly, and I'm really pleased to hear you celebrate some of the Australian work that's happening in this space internationally. I think it does begin with the domestic policy framework, and I wondered whether you had any comment on priorities for the next iteration of the Australian National Plan on Women, Peace and Security, which will be launched in 2018.
Okay. That's enough to bite off at the moment.
Yes, yes. Thank you for that. Well, Ava Cox, you have pioneered the work to which you refer. In terms of the broader question of, you know, how we reshape an agenda, how we get something valued that's traditionally not valued, I mean, we all know that change is so slow. I mean, I refer to my legislative work as, you know, Pantene moments. Remember the commercial? Won't happen overnight, but it will happen. Sometimes it just takes so long for it to happen. And, you know, the classic case, you know, to which I apply that notion is the issue of parental leave. So there's part of me that thinks at some point when men and women, and particularly men because they're in positions of power, when they start to see something as valuable to their own lives, not just for the country's good, then obviously it reshapes an agenda. The idea of parental leave generally or you know, leave for, you know, paternal leave specifically, that was instrumental in changing the agenda on that legislation. And believe me, that hurts for me because, you know, why is it that when, say, a former prime minister who is male talks about the importance of it, even though the same person may have blocked my legislation for many, many years, but you know, I'm a realist, I get it. So part of it's going to be when people change their minds about how this affects them particularly. You know what I'd love to see? Of course I'd love to see GDP calculations include what is currently unpaid work. And there are very good reasons why that's not going to happen for a long time. It suits leaders in countries across the world. So how do we reshape the agenda so that it does suit them? You know, how do we start to get those leaders, a couple of whom, you know, to whom I referred, to actually start wanting to outdo each other on how much money they put into the social space or indeed, you know, compare their growth on the fact that there might be the inclusion of some of those things that traditionally not not considered important. But I also shouldn't treat this as inevitability because we know one thing from the women's movement, eternal vigilance is required. And I see reforms often going backwards that I didn't think would go backwards. And this ties in a bit with Angela, your question about women in Parliament. You know, I got in 21 years ago last week. 14% of the Parliament was female. I know it's a long time ago. 14% of the Parliament was female. In 21 years, I thought it'll be parity for sure. I didn't think we'd be still struggling to say, hey, but we've got critical mass. I mean, I go the first time I met with the Timorese delegation, and they said, you know, Ambassador, we're terribly sorry. We've only got 38% female representation in our national parliament. I was like, I'll take that. They didn't realise that we were still sort of limping towards the early 30s. So, again, I go back to that comment, and forgive me for trying to address two questions in one go, women in those positions of power. And I'm not saying it's women's responsibility, although I just happen to feel as a feminist that women who get into parliament have a special obligation. But so do men. It's in their interests, it's in our country's interests for economic, social and other reasons. But yeah, we need to get it back onto the agenda, and I think the UN and other multilateral groups can actually help shape that agenda. But yeah, obviously the role of country is important as well. In relation to quotas, I mean, I can't give you a specific answer or recipe on this. What I can say though, quotas work, let's implement them. Let's support those countries that are doing them or considering them. And there are ways that we already do that. So, for example, in Sri Lanka, where they've introduced a quota for the first time, they amended their municipal act for local government elections this year. So what did I do? Launched, among other things, not only training programs to assist those, you know, aspiring candidates, but a public awareness campaign. Because in Sri Lanka, not unlike many other countries around the world, the issue of perceptions, that it's men's work, it's not for women, that in fact women will mostly vote against women running for parliament because we need to change this notion that they have a role. So we can support and fund candidates and training and, you know, public awareness campaigns. We actually were responsible for funding a lot of the women, a lot of the programs that supported the women in the Samoan elections. I think, though, there's also an element of public diplomacy that is incredibly important. And it's not just up to the Office for Women or the Minister for Women or indeed the Minister for Foreign Affairs. It's up to every minister, male or female, in our governments and those of you in the business and other sectors to make clear when dealing with counterparts that it's not acceptable to us to deal with countries that have no women as members of parliament. And I did sit, you know, I had a long discussion with some ministers in Papua New Guinea a few weeks ago, and they actually said to me, you know, Natasha, you should know that it's got to be on merit. And I just thought, I've just been spending time with, you know, 30, 40 women who run rings around most of us. Don't tell me, you know, it's about merit. So some of those age-old arguments, and don't get me wrong, I know I've read all the surveys, I've seen all the research, I've spoken to women, I know that financing of elections is a huge issue. I know corruption in some countries is a big issue. There are lots of other issues, but what's the one thing that we know that works? Temporary special measures. And I think one of the things I found in the regional meeting that we had for the Pacific Women Parliamentary Program last time was that some of the Samoan, including male members, Marshall Islands delegates came, and they had already just defeated a proposal or a debate around quotas. And the Samoan Deputy Prime Minister, Fiame, gave a speech in favour of quotas. And after that meeting, they went back and said, well, maybe this isn't as scary as we thought. Maybe this would be quite good. So working together in a regional framework is a good idea. But yes, I think there's a lot that we can do. I think we're starting to do it. But I also think there's a very clear political as well as diplomatic role for our country. In terms of Women, Peace and Security agenda, I think we've done incredibly well with the work that we have been able to showcase, whether it's the work that we've done through AFP, whether it's through our defence forces, whether it's to do with gender advisors, whether it's to do with showcasing the extraordinary things that we've done in our region. That's another example of what I find in multilateral fora. People are surprised. They forget. When we're talking conflict and post-conflict environments, we've got them in our backyard. And the work that we've done with women in Solomons or Philippines or indeed through Bougainville and the peace agreements and accords that we've been involved in there, I think, you know, it's not resting on our laurels, but I think some of those areas are absolute examples for the world. And I think that's, you know, probably an important step in terms of us getting attention in the global arena. In terms of the National Action Plan, I suspect the next iteration will be as comprehensive and impressive as the first. And I acknowledge the good work of people like yourself who've been involved in this space. Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if we had a bit longer on the Security Council to continue? But we do influence those resolutions, as you well know, whether it's arms trade, whether it's a whole range of other issues that get women at the centre. And I mentioned briefly the issue of countering violent extremism. I suspect that might be part of the next iteration of these Women, Peace and Security agenda items.
Okay, so we can take another couple of questions. Jonathan Pryke at the back there from the Lowy Institute.
Thank you. Jonathan Pryke. I'm a research fellow in the Melanesia program here at the Institute. Mm-hmm. So I'm deeply ashamed to be part of the gender that is, you know, so responsible for a lot of the violence and inequality we see in the world. But also, in addition to that, I'm ashamed of how little men engage to try and fix it. I mean, you look around the room here, 20% of the audience maybe is made up by men. And we held a similar event in May, both here and in Canberra, looking at gender-based violence in PNG, where we had even less men attendance.
Wow.
And I'm sure that's a story you see repeated over and over in your position. I'd just be interested in your insights about how we can better engage, and I'm talking all advocates in this space, not only in the Pacific, but also here at home, how better we can engage men in this discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Over here. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks, Ambassador. Sharon Pinney from the Canadian Consulate in Sydney. And I've been in my role 21 years, but I was interested to have you comment more and perhaps personally from about the work harmony aspect. And I'll just frame that with the comments that you made about the numbers of domestic violence, particularly in the Pacific, and I know it's very high in Australia. And personally, I'm a victim of domestic violence, and I found at that time it was very hard for me to hold an executive position. And I can look back, and I noticed she's mentioned you traveled 43 times in the last 3 years. That was one of the hardest things for me, going through a situation that was traumatic and being in an executive that was expected to travel and to worry about my children being away while I was trying to keep my career going. How are you going to get these women in those roles in the Pacific that require a high career? Just if you could comment a little bit on how you balance work, life, harmony. Because I look back now, and this happened 7 years ago, but it really impacted my work for at least 5 years. And I think my employer and the support they gave me, it must have been so hard for them, but that's why I was able to keep my sanity and my job, which has been a lifeline for me. And we need women to stay in executive positions and be, you know, walking the career ladder. So I see that work-life harmony as a huge issue.
Okay, and then just behind Hannah Wirth.
Hi, I'm Hannah Wirth. I also work here at the Lowe Institute on economic governance issues. I actually wanted to ask you about the implementation of targets, because I see a lot of new global targets. The G20 has a labour participation target. The UN has its targets. The SDG5. So we've got all these great targets. How do we make sure that there's not just the headline announcement that we've made this great, you know, we've made this great commitment, but then how do we know that implementation is happening, and when we're backsliding on things as well?
Oh, wonderful questions. Keep me to time. I'll start with the last one. Obviously, yeah, you know, I talk about the SDGs as this wonderful blueprint, you know, to leave no one behind, the 17 goals and then hundreds of targets. I'm not under any illusion as to how difficult this is to implement, and that it's also open to interpretations depending on member countries, how they choose to evaluate or monitor their particular, or indeed how the multilateral institutions decide to keep, tabs on various member states. But monitoring and evaluation, number one, I think recognising that when we talk about international development or NGOs or indeed United Nations, that funding for research and data matters. I was honoured to do some work recently with Melinda Gates, where actually Australia has put some money into, supporting the work on not only evaluation but actually collecting data on women. And, you know, only Melinda Gates could make, data sexy, but, I just felt cool going, yeah, data, 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 data. But it is, it matters. I didn't mention it in my speech, but of course it matters. Monitoring, evaluation, data keeping. Also, I don't know about you, but I have tested my son on the 17 goals. Don't know if any of you go home, just reel them off? No? Okay, there's a song about that. But anyway, I thought we should survey our leaders. How many members of the cabinet, diplomat, not politician, sorry, how many people in government know about the SDGs in any detail? So there's a role for civil society in keeping governments accountable in their own countries and more broadly. But I share your concerns and possibly your optimism too, because the SDGs, I think, is great, and I love the fact that it does have targets. Obviously, I love the gender goal. I love the mainstreaming of gender throughout the 17 goals. But you're right, it's not worth anything unless it's monitored, evaluated, and, of course, there's implementation. Work and family balance? Well, yeah, talk to me about that. But it's the same for everyone, is it not? It's elusive.
We do the best we can, but obviously I'm in a slightly different position from some of my Pacific neighbours and women. I mean, I talk about the Pacific being invisible in some contexts. Well, that's because the, you know, some of the leading women of the Pacific, you know, it's so difficult logistically, financially and otherwise for them to be at these worldwide gatherings. So that's where we have to work out as governments and civil society and NGOs how we can assist and facilitate that process. In terms of, you know, honestly, the hardest thing about the last 3 years for me, of course, has been work and family. I've got two relatively young children. That's why I decided to leave the Senate 8 years ago. It hasn't got easier. It's really been difficult, as it is for most of you in your various ways, male, female, working parents, whatever nomenclature we use. And let's face it, don't all parents work? So I think that it's a perennial difficult one. So what do? Well, we've got to provide support structures. It's why I've been passionate about the things that Ava and Anne and many other women and men in the room are committed to. We have to provide a suite of reforms that facilitate women's participation in public life, in private sector, in whatever it may be, work and family. Even if it's just not making women feel guilty now for making choices, because surely that's what it's all about, us having equal choice to our male counterparts. And even then, I'm sure that a lot of men in the room would say, hey, we don't necessarily feel that we can make those choices. So we're only going to achieve this so-called balance or a gender-equal society where we have respectful relationships and healthy relationships between men and women until we cut down on some of those stereotypes and rigid roles to which we, you know, adhere, whether we like it or not. The domestic violence issue, as you well know, is another issue, and I, you know, I'm passionate about that, and that's part of my work internationally, and it's a big part of my work going on domestically. And by the way, Canada, congratulations, bit of a rock star cabinet there, and your Prime Minister did announce that he was a feminist at the most recent Commission on the Status of Women. So, yep, we're working. Yep, good one, you. And I do look forward to seeing the results of your gender equality international strategy, which I think has just been launched, and we hope very much so that your government will consider an ambassador for women and girls. That's one last thing. Engaging with men and boys, absolutely critical. We do a lot of work in the region ensuring that men are a part of the gender equal work that we do, particularly when it comes to preventing violence against women and girls. We actually know, of course, as you know, that male role models are critical in this space when it comes to eliminating violence specifically, but more generally. What role can men play? Well, you know, when you talk about the fact that there was minimal men in the room for your event earlier in the year in terms of ending violence against women, I mean, I'm really into, you know, we take the panel pledge, don't we? But it matters. I went to the World Humanitarian Summit this year, having just been the week before to the Women Deliver Conference in Denmark. Brilliant. One of the best conferences I've been to in my lifetime, if not the best. And it was sort of like an alternative universe, but it was men, women, all of these issues, diversity and difference. Went to Turkey, to the WHS. Very few women represented, even though women's issues, I thought, were the core of the humanitarian crisis. And I sat on panels where there were only male speakers, or I watched, you know, the welcome party where, you know, a man got up, said a few words, introduced another man, and then a third man. And I'm going, this is weird, because the symbolism, UN wouldn't normally do this, and then said, could we have all the organisers up to the stage? 35 men walked onto the stage, at which case the High Commission and all the embassies are saying, just calm, Natasha, it'll be fine. I tell you what, if Daniel Craig hadn't been there, it would have been a really messy evening, just saying. Notice how I got that one in as well as Brad Pitt.
Thanks, I'll add that to my list.
But more seriously, men have a role. You don't have to wait to be asked. You know that. It's part of who you talk to, how you use your own power, the kind of, you know, bystander and other education that you support. But I tell you what, I've introduced a summit pledge to the UN, and I'm hoping that countries will adopt it. They do not have a summit on any kind of humanitarian, let alone other issues, unless women are reflected and represented. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? But I think, you know, there are many things that you and your male and female colleagues can do, but absolutely leading by example is possibly the most important way. But, I don't want to ever go into a room again where I'm one of the few women. I did that in Parliament for long enough. We've all done it, whether it's in business, industry and elsewhere. But we shouldn't have to anymore. And I think that's a role that men can play. It's not always hard work to find the women or support the women. As a sister, I will always do that. But I want my brothers to do it as well. So please.
Thank you, Natasha. As an equal opportunity organisation, I'm sorry we've run out of time for questions. I'd like to ask Dr. Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Institute, to come up and give the vote of thanks. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Alex. To Natasha's final point, we've always felt here at the Institute that conversations are much more interesting, more substantial, more likely to get at the truth when women are included in them as well as men, and I think today is evidence of that. I'm fortunate to have here at the Institute a large number of brilliant female colleagues, and one of them, Alex Oliver, our chair today, has carriage of our most famous product, research product, the Lowy Institute poll. Natasha, you mentioned the panel pledge. I think there's nothing more boring than an all-male panel, and that's one of the reasons we don't have them. And I think today has shown what a waste all-male panels would be. What a terrific speech. Thank you very much. I first met Natasha. Natasha, you made a couple of self-deprecating gags about your age. We first met almost a quarter of a century ago, I'm afraid. We met through the Republican movement. We both had a view then that Australia's head of state should be an Australian. Of course, it's great that our head of state is a female, but it would be good if it were a female Australian, an Australian female. So we met through the Republican movement. Since then, she's had a distinguished career as a senator, a party leader, and now for the last 3 years as our ambassador for women and girls. Please join me in thanking Natasha Stott-Despoir, not just for an excellent speech, but for her work over the past 3 years. Thanks, Natasha.